This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It will take years of sustained hard work, perseverance, maturity, and cooperation across all sectors of society to get our country back on track.
That was John Steenhuisen, leader of the South Africa's Democratic Alliance Party, on the challenges facing the new coalition government. Details coming up. Also, on Sunday, Muslims will celebrate Eid al-Adha, marking the end of the pilgrimage to Mecca. And as many people celebrate Father's Day, where does that leave those who grow up without a father? These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But we start with our top story. Sudan's army says its forces have killed the central commander of Darfur of the Sudanese paramilitary rapid support forces, or RSF, Ali Yagub Jibril, a figure who was under U.S. sanctions. According to Reuters News, the army says Jibril died during a battle in the city of Al-Fashir. VOA's John Tanza from South Sudan in Focus News Radio program has received photos and videos via WhatsApp that appear to show Jibril's dead body being displaced by Sudan Armed Forces soldiers. The photos and videos show people viewing Jibril's body in Al-Fashir. People surrounding the area were cheering in celebration, and celebratory gunfire was heard on the video. Jibril was a leading commander for the RSF in Al-Fashir, the last major city in the Darfur region of Sudan that the paramilitary force does not control. The army said in a statement, Yakub was killed as an RSF attack was thwarted early on Friday by its troops and allied joint forces fighting alongside it, a reference to non-Arab former rebel group from Darfur that had aligned with the army. The RSF has been besieging Al-Fashir, a city of 1.8 million people, for weeks, and UN officials have warned that the worsening conflict there could trigger widespread intercommunal violence. The UN Security Council on Thursday called for a halt to the siege. And as we go to air, South Africans are waiting for the results of the presidential election in the country's parliament. Members have voted all afternoon. Incumbent Cyril Ramaphosa is widely expected to win after his African National Congress agreed on a coalition government with the second largest party, the Democratic Alliance. A few weeks ago, the ANC slumped to its worst ever election result, winning only 40% of the vote. This forced it to negotiate support to form a coalition government. Darren Taylor reports.
Before the vote, Democratic Alliance leader John Steenhuisen said the basis of his party's agreement with the African National Congress is shared respect for the constitution and rule of law. In a nationally broadcast speech, he said the DA and ANC will unite to do what's best for South Africans and that the unity government will implement many reforms the DA has suggested.
The basic minimum program contained in the statement also commits the government of national unity to building a merit-based, non-partisan and professional public service that puts the people first. Strengthening law enforcement agencies to address crime, corruption, and gender-based violence.
The DA made some concessions, agreeing not to oppose flagship ANC policies such as affirmative action. ANC Secretary General Fikile Mbalula said the new government would gravitate toward the center. In a concession to the DA, the ANC pledged to stop installing party loyalists in key public service positions and to give the DA cabinet positions. Steenhuisen said the road ahead will not be easy.
South Africa has the highest unemployment rates in the world. It has one of the highest crime rates in the world. Logistics and infrastructure is in an advanced state of decline, and corruption is endemic. It will take years of sustained hard work, perseverance, maturity, and cooperation across all sectors of society to get our country back on track.
The new government leaves out South Africa's two most leftist parties, Umkhonto weSizwe, MK, and the Economic Freedom Fighters, the EFF. They advocate constitutional changes to allow state control of all forms of wealth, including land, banks, and mines, allowing government to seize private property for redistribution to the poor. Many financial analysts say this would likely result in economic collapse, with investors and taxpayers leaving the country. Former President Jacob Zuma, who leads the MK, demanded that ANC leader Cyril Ramaphosa step down from the presidency for MK to join a coalition. The ANC rejected that demand. ANC negotiator and former Deputy President Phumzile Mlambo-Ngcuka told VOA her party had no choice but to exclude the EFF and MK.
I think it's important to build bridges, but it's also important to call on everyone that is going to be in parliament to respect the constitution and the rule of law. It is a delicate balance. It is a difficult one to navigate, but the ANC has to make sure that it surrounds itself with people it can work with. I have no doubt that it's not possible to be with the DA and not disagree. They will disagree, but they have to fight for the rights of those who voted for them.
The EFF, MK, and the ANC's more radical members say the DA represents the interests of South Africa's white minority and its policies are anti-poor. The deal for the new government has angered some leftist ANC members and the party's alliance partners, the Communist Party and trade unions. The danger now, say some analysts, is that these forces split from the ANC to either join the EFF and MK or to form a significant rival to the coalition government. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The announcement on the vote for the presidency will be coming later today. You can follow this and other stories on voaafrica.com. On Sunday, Muslims around the world will be celebrating Eid al-Adha, marking the end of the pilgrimage to Mecca. In the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, many Muslims say they are finding it difficult to celebrate this important Islamic festival because of the region's security situation. Zanem Natizaidi from Goma has the details.
Eid al-Adha or Eid al-Kabir is the most important of the Muslim festivals. It is known as Tabaski in the countries of West and Central Africa. Amadi Kitsa is a displaced person living in the Buhimba camp near Goma in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. He says he doesn't think he'll be able to find anything to eat this Sunday at home, but he will still go to the mosque to thank Allah and pray for the return of peace in the country. Many Muslims living in Goma also say they are unable to celebrate Eid this year as they have been economically affected by the conflict in North Kivu province. M23 rebels and ADF militants, among other groups, have been battling the government for the region for years, displacing thousands of people and destroying farms and businesses. Mwajuma Kasiwa is a Muslim woman from Goma. She says that for the moment, Muslims are finding it very difficult to celebrate the Tabaski because of the economic crisis caused by the war. In the past, everyone could find the means to buy a goat, a cow, or other things. But at the moment, life is becoming very complicated for people. Analyst Patrick Sheria studies social and security issues, says Muslims in North Kivu province should adapt to the current situation in the region and celebrate Eid al-Adha in different ways. He says this festival is often commemorated in the form of animal sacrifice, and it generally shaped that Muslims slaughter for this great festival, given the current economic situation, especially in the context of the conflict in North Kivu province. He suggests that the leaders of the Muslim community see how they can shorten things on the occasion of this festival by celebrating it in a symbolic way. Eid al-Adha commemorates the prophet Abraham, who was willing to sacrifice his son for God. Instead, God sent Abraham a ram to sacrifice. The holiday also follows the last day of the Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca. For VOA Africa, I'm Zane Mnechi Zaidi in Goma.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. A U.S. president can serve a maximum of 8 years. So, whether Joe Biden or Donald Trump is victorious in November, it would be their final term. Trump, however, is musing about a possible third term. From Washington, VOA Chief National Correspondent Steve Herman explains.
Campaigning for a second term, Donald Trump asked America's largest gun lobby last month about whether he might get a third term, referencing the four terms of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who died in office in 1945.
FDR, 16 years, almost 16 years, he was four term. I don't know, are we going to be considered three term or two term? You tell me. Ronnie, what do you think?
Congress in 1947 approved the 22nd Amendment to the Constitution, limiting presidents to just a pair of four-year terms. That became law in 1951, after the amendment was ratified by the necessary 36 of the then 48 states.
The amendment really codifies what had been for a long time a political norm of not running for more than two terms.
That's Praveen Fernandez, vice president of the Constitutional Accountability Center. He explains the two-term tradition goes back to America's first president, George Washington, who ignored repeated pleas to run for a third term. With the start of the Second World War, Franklin Roosevelt broke with that tradition in 1940 and won a fourth term in 1944 as well.
I, Barack Hussein Obama.
Since the 22nd Amendment, six presidents have served two full terms, the most recent being Barack Obama. A prominent supporter for President Joe Biden, actor Robert De Niro, labels Trump a tyrant who wants to be president for life.
If he gets in, I can tell you right now, he will never leave. He will never leave. You know that. He will never leave.
I only want to be a dictator for one day.
Such declarations by Trump in this election cycle come as he faces criminal charges for attempting to overturn the 2020 election results. And that may presage future intent, according to constitutional attorney Fernandez.
The comments that Donald Trump recently made about a third term, which of course flies right in the face of clear constitutional text, are another reason to have concerns about someone who doesn't feel constrained by the clear text of our laws.
The President of the United States.
For Trump to legally pursue a third term, the 22nd Amendment would have to be repealed, and that would require a two-thirds vote in both chambers of Congress, and then ratification by at least 38 of the 50 states. Or 34 states could call a constitutional convention, and any action they approve would have to be ratified by 38 states. Only once in American history has a constitutional amendment been repealed.
Acting Secretary of State William Phillips is signing the 21st Amendment, and prohibition is repealed.
The 21st Amendment, ratified in 1933, annulled the unpopular and frequently violated 18th Amendment, which in 1919 banned alcoholic beverages. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
On Sunday, many countries will celebrate Father's Day, a day honoring fathers and father figures. But what is the impact on someone who does not have one? Nafana Namusi is a journalist and a community work organizer in Nairobi who grew up without a father, and a psychologist, Juliet Mutoni, in Nairobi, conducted research on how absent fathers affect younger women's choices. Both spoke with VOA intern, reporter Brian Itava from Nairobi, Kenya. Brian started by asking Nafuna her thoughts on Father's Day.
Father's Day is a very special day to honor fathers and father figures in our lives. So for someone like me who doesn't have a father, I choose to celebrate the people who fill that gap in my life, and that is people like my uncle, who has stood by me like my father, and my mom, who has been all around, you know, just juggling to be between fatherhood and motherhood and trying to create that balance in my life.
You mentioned that your uncle is a very important figure in your life. Why is that?
When he realized there's no father figure in my life, he chose to fill that gap, and he became a father in that he was there to support me emotionally, guide me in everything that a father would. Also, when it comes to resources and making choices in life, he made sure that he would be there, he listened to me. He's just held my hand in every step of my life.
Do you think you'd be better off with your own biological father as a whole in your life?
Of course. In as much as he's tried to be there and to fill the gap, there are always moments when you sit down and you feel like it would have been better or it would have been different if my own father were here. You know, there are some connections which only a father would have with a daughter, and it's not the same with an uncle.
Let's bring in an expert on the subject. Juliet, why is it important that somebody have their own father, like their biological father? Why isn't that gap able to be filled by anyone else?
There's some emotional aspect that he can provide that a mother, on the other hand, can't. So a father will provide the male aura in the child's life. If this is a man, if they're looking up to their father, they will look up to the father in terms of what are the roles, what are the responsibilities, how should I behave as a man. Those are things that a boy cannot learn from a mother. If a father is absent, whether the child is a male or a female child, there's going to be a certain level of exposure that they will lack if they don't get this father figure. And in terms of provision, allow me to just stretch a bit far. One of the things I was actually doing in my dissertation, I wanted to understand, could it be that some women attach to older men emotionally, not because they want any financial help? Could it be it's related to the lack of a father as they grew up? According to the research we've done in the last 3 years, we have more than 50% women who have been affected in their childhood by having an absent father, and they attach to a male figure looking for emotional needs and not even financial.
Back to Nafuna, what would you like to tell those that don't have a father or a father figure?
It is okay, you know. It doesn't mean you're limited. It doesn't make you any less. Look for people around you whom you can confide in.
Juliet, do you have any word for absentee fathers?
The most important thing is, am I an absent father? And if I am, where can I start collecting myself? Because at the end of the day, you have a responsibility and a duty towards that child that you brought into this world. So if you leave that child, that means at one point, this child is either going to enact the same behavior as you did, or they might find healing, which is usually like 80%. So instead of spreading the trauma, I would recommend you just heal and spread the healing.
That was VOA News intern Brian Itava speaking with journalist and community organizer Nafuna Namisu and psychologist Juliet Mutoni about how growing up without a father can affect girls and young women. While the United Nations does not compile global figures on the number of fatherless children, the U.S. Census Bureau shows that in 2020, about 20% of American children lived in homes without a father. The Census Bureau and research in some other countries report that children who grow up without a father or father figure are statistically more likely to be aggressive, depressed, have low self-esteem, do poorly in school, be incarcerated, commit suicide, and use drugs. And now, in our sports section, I have our VOA sports analyst Mokbilia Baro on African News Tonight today to wrap up the week and look ahead. Thanks for being on the show, Mokbilia.
Thanks for having me, Hayes.
So, the FIFA World Cup African qualifiers started back up this week. What were some of the shocking results?
All right, if we're just going to first start off, Morocco versus Congo. 6-0 for the Moroccans. We already know the level by which the Moroccans have been playing in the last couple of years. We saw them at the last World Cup, making it the furthest distance by where an African team has made it. So this is not really a shocker. They are at the top of Group E for the World Cup African qualifiers. Another shocking result was Benin beating Nigeria. The Super Eagles, who were just in the finals, just lost in the finals of AFCON, went down and lost 2-1 after scoring the first goal, actually. So they were up 1-0, and then they still lost. Right now in that group, Group C, Nigeria is in fifth place, looking like they will not be able to qualify for the World Cup, which is, a huge blow for not only Nigeria, but for the continent when you have the most populous country that influences so much not be able to partake in the biggest soccer stage. Now, lastly, I have Comoros, a small island town off of East Africa, beating Chad 2-0. They are at the top of the group in Group I with 9 points. They have three big wins. In that group is also Ghana and Mali, who are two heavyweights that were expected to be 1-2 in that group. But somehow, maybe something in the water.
From soccer to basketball, the Boston Celtics have a 3-0 lead over the Dallas Mavericks in the NBA Finals. Can Boston sweep the Mavericks tonight?
Definitely very possible, Yehaeus. If we're just looking at what this Boston Celtics team does really well is that they continuously play this style of basketball from their defensive assignments. All of their key players are also playing extremely well on the defensive end. So when you have a guy like a Jaylen Brown or a Jason Tatum that is able to score 30 points, but also make sure that their defensive assignment is really there, they're locked in, they are playing for each other. You have players like a Drew Holiday that can play on both sides, Derek White. The team is just a more complete team, unfortunately, for the Dallas Mavericks. They have Luka Doncic, who is an amazing offensive player, as well as Kyrie Irving. But Luka on the defensive end has been subpar, if I'm keeping it light. He has not been playing defense at all. And without that, they're not going to be able to win. So they're playing their second game at home. Hopefully, they're able to get one win. But we will see tonight.
VOA sports analyst Mokbilia Baro, thank you for your input.
Thanks for having me.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Justin Twait, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.